Welcome back to the Iron Rod Podcast. This is Chris, and I'm joined by Taylor and by Quinn Easton. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Glad to be here, as always.
Yeah, welcome, Quinn. And I also am happy to be here on the day before Thanksgiving, Wednesday afternoon.
That's right. It is. So after this is over, I'm going to have to start doing a little baking to get ready for tomorrow. In today's episode, we're going to cover sections 102 and 103. 102 isn't actually a revelation. So these are actually minutes from a meeting that was held on February 17th in 1834. They used this meeting to address a lot of the questions that had been asked around the organization of the High Council and what it was supposed to do and how it was supposed to act and such. And so then they discussed it during the meeting and they made notes. And then Joseph went and spent a couple other days working on amending those minutes to make sure it really reflected the way he thought things should be run, and then presented it back. And the council unanimously voted to accept the revised minutes as, quote, a form and constitution of the High Council of the Church of Christ hereafter. And that was on February 19th when they held that follow-up meeting, and Joseph reported, quote, that the council was organized according to the ancient order and also according to the mind of God. Any comments before we dive on in?
I'll just make one. I have personal experience with Section 102. It is procedures for holding these councils, what the church now calls courts. Actually, they call them membership councils today. Going into that, I wanted to make sure that they were following, you know, the Lord's instruction in 102 by dividing up the council, et cetera. And we'll get into that. I took a keen interest in 102 earlier this year.
Understandable.
It's pretty interesting how in going through the Doctrine and Covenants and really getting into some of the history, you identify what's truly a revelation and what was just perhaps inspired counsel or perhaps just minutes of organization. I think it happens so often for some that they just quote straight out and say, well, this is in the scriptures, therefore stamp of approval accepted, no questions asked. And yet, once you actually get into what is the word of the Lord and what is perhaps the application of trying to apply wisdom, and not all of it is necessarily in accordance with the word of the Lord. That's my two cents.
That's a good point. One other thing I'll point out is that even though this was just the minutes of a meeting in February of 1834, in the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants, not only did Joseph publish this as a section, but it was section number 5. And he Right. organized things thematically and kind of in level of importance. This was number 5 out of 100 sections. So he obviously thought it was fairly important, even if it wasn't revelation. Well, let's get started. Verse 1. This day, a general council of 24 high priests assembled at the house of Joseph Smith Jr. by revelation and proceeded to organize the High Council of the Church of Christ, which was to consist of 12 high priests and one or three presidents as the case might require. The High Council was appointed by revelation for the purpose of settling important difficulties which might arise in the church, which could not be settled by the church or the bishop's council to the satisfaction of the parties.
So two things strike me here. One, I ask myself, well, where is this High Council today? If this is such an important body, what is it? And there's no identification of members of the council as being apostles, only high priests. So the Lord's not saying that this group is necessarily apostles. He's saying that there are 12 high priests with a president or presidents. We'll see a little bit later on that there's a distinction between this council and then the council of the traveling elders, which is, I believe, a reference to the apostles.
And keep in mind, in 1834, it's a full year before the Quorum of the Twelve is organized. So there is no formal Quorum of Apostles right now. This council is comprised of high priests.
Exactly.
And the other thing I would say is this was intended to be kind of an appeals court, because the cases were supposed to be heard by the church or by the bishop's council. And it was only when those weren't able to come to a conclusion that the cases would be referred to this council. So this is kind of an appeals court, or almost a Supreme Court, if we were to use a legal analogy.
And one would think that whatever these decisions are, they would be made public, right? I mean, the Lord doesn't work in the dark. And yet, I've heard of people appealing their excommunications, for example, to higher authority. And the church rarely, if ever, to my knowledge, convenes some high council of the Church of Christ here to hear that appeal. It's usually rejected. And yet it says, which could not be settled by the church or the bishop's council to the satisfaction of the parties. And I know so many individuals who have not been satisfied with the decision of the local high council, who've appealed to the church and it's been ignored or just shuffled aside, even though there was no satisfaction on the part of the accused.
That's a good point, because it is to the satisfaction of the parties, plural, which would imply if either one of the two parties is not happy with it, then it needs to be bounced up to this high council for the whole church. Verse 3, Joseph Smith Jr., Sidney Rigdon, and Frederick G. Williams were acknowledged presidents by the voice of the council, and Joseph Smith Sr., John Smith, Joseph Coey, John Johnson, Martin Harris, John Carter, Jared Carter, Oliver Cowdery, Samuel Smith, Orson Hyde, Sylvester Smith, and Luke Johnson, high priests, were chosen to be a standing council for the church by the unanimous voice of the council. The above-named counselors were then asked whether they accepted their appointments and whether they would act in that office according to the law of heaven, to which they all answered that they accepted their appointments and would fill their offices according to the grace of God bestowed upon them. And the other thing that just jumps out at me, this is a standing council for the church. So these 12 were kind of a perpetual council that wasn't just created ad hoc when there was a need and then disassembled. It was a standing council for the entire church. So it's not the stake high council. This is a church high council.
And I believe at that time, Sidney, Joseph, and Frederick were the first presidency. So it comprised of the first presidency of the church and then 12 high priests.
Yep, that's what I read.
Is this applying to the church outside of Zion, or is this also applying to the church in Zion? Because in previous revelations, there seems to be a distinction between the church in Zion and the churches elsewhere. You know, some applying directly to Zion and not applying outside of Zion, and vice versa. So is this in reference to the church 100% inclusive of all?
I don't see any reason to draw a different conclusion, Quinn, based upon the text. There's nothing that carves out Zion as separate from the church. But you can see how there was a presidency in Zion and a presidency in Kirtland. But I just don't see a distinction here between the two for this council.
The thing that I would point to is later on in like verses 26 and 27, where it talks about the high council of the seat of the first presidency of the church versus the other high councils. So these other high councils would escalate the cases all the way up to the high council. They, even when they made decisions, they had to write it up and send a full statement to this high council of the seat of the first presidency. Yeah, I agree that there are places where it talks about the church in Zion and the church in Kirtland, but this seems to be one example where he's just saying, no, this high council at the seat of the first presidency is the supreme body.
That's the conclusion I came to, too, but it was an interesting thought process just to think about, to perhaps parse.
The other thing, verse 5, kind of interesting here. The number composing the council who voted in the name and for the church in appointing the above-named counselors were 43. So this is a little bit confusing because the people at the meeting, they're calling the council, and then they create this council of 12. But there were 43 who voted to create this. 9 were high priests, 17 elders, 4 priests, and 13 members. When was the last time rank and file members were allowed to participate in the creation of the highest council of the church?
And actually vote on it, right?
Before the decision's made, yes.
Yeah, it's not just a sustaining vote. It speaks to the democratic approach that the Lord has with regards to his church, instead of the autocratic approach that we have today, where you really have no say. You either agree or you don't. And if you don't, talk to your stake president.
And when you do talk to the stake president, nothing's going to change. Nothing you say is going to change the decision. He's just going to tell you you're wrong, and that's the end of it. They're not going to do anything about it.
Your name may be put on the naughty list.
Yeah, you'll definitely be put on a watch list, that's for sure.
So if we keep going, verse 6, I don't know that we need to spend much time. There's a requirement that a quorum be present to do any business, and it was voted that they're able to replace those who, for some reason, either through transgression or death or moving or whatever, can be replaced. So it's just very businesslike in verses 6, 7, and 8.
Yeah, the one thing I'll point out is in verse 8, where it talks about if there's an empty position on this council of 12, it shall be filled by the nomination of the president or presidents and sanctioned by the voice of a general council of high priests convened for that purpose to act in the name of the church. When does that happen in our modern church?
Yeah, that would seem to suggest a wider audience than just the remaining 11 high priests on the high council. And yet what we have in the church today is this self-perpetuating little group. If you're in, you're in, and they get to select who they're going to bring in. Again, the democracy that's been taken from us is on full display here in verse 8.
It goes on talking about absences in the presidency of this. And I think verse 11 is really critical, that in the case of the absence of one or both of those who are appointed to assist this president, he has power to preside over the council without an assistant. Okay, we all accept that. And in case he himself is absent, the other presidents have power to preside in his stead, both or either of them. Wait a minute. The whole succession crisis was saying that once Joseph and Hiram were no longer present, Sidney had no authority to preside. And yet this here seems to indicate that he still does. Even when they are absent, he can still preside.
Well, and Brigham Young put into our history basically a lie. I'll call it what it is. I mean, he had written in there that Joseph supposedly said that where I am not, there is no first presidency. And yet that is clearly an after the fact justification for why he could take over as the president of the 12 apostles. But verse 11 here, as you point out, is critical to understanding that, I mean, there's a reason why all three are called presidents, because they can equally stand in that office if one or the other two are not there.
But our tradition has created something else that contradicts this, so no need to discuss it further. Let's move along.
Nothing to see here, folks.
Verse 13 talks about how they're to take numbers and decide who gets to talk first and how many people are going to talk. The more difficult the case, the more people that talk. And then verse 15, I think this is what you were referring to, Taylor. You want to walk us through that since you have personal experience?
Yeah, I mean, it talks about how the accused has a right to one half of the council, you know, not as a defense per se, but to prevent insult or injustice. So if the prosecution, for lack of a better term, is insulting or presenting false facts or something, that's where those who pick even numbers of the 12, so 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, and 12. And I actually asked in my trial, I said, which of the members of the council have selected even numbers? Those members of the council were lined up on the left side of the table. And so the stake president obviously had read this and been through this and wasn't trying to circumvent this particular instruction. And so 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, and 12 were lined up. And then 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11 were on my right. I was just curious to see if they were going to follow the procedure, and they did.
Oh, that's good. I wasn't aware that they still did that.
Yeah, they did.
And what about this other one in verse 18? In all cases, the accuser and the accused shall have a privilege of speaking for themselves before the council after the evidences are heard. So did they actually present evidence of your apostasy and then have you respond to that evidence?
Yeah, they went through and they cited various things in my book. They asked me to verify if, you know, are you teaching that the temple endowment is not of God? And yeah, I mean, I said, read the book, of course. It's all right there. I mean, I admitted to those facts. There's no reason for me to deny what I actually wrote in the book. It was a member of the stake presidency that presented their case, for lack of a better term. And then they handed me a piece of paper and said, can you answer these questions? And so I went through and addressed the various questions. At the end of the day, it was largely a foregone conclusion because the criteria for apostasy is not following the brethren. And if something in scripture points out that the brethren are off base, and that's what I'm teaching, then, you know, by their apostate definition of apostasy, I'm in apostasy. So it was largely a foregone conclusion. I knew that from the beginning. What I felt was unfair, though, was the fact that I was only given 30 minutes to defend myself. Straight up from the very beginning, 30 minutes. And that 30 minutes flew by like a blink of the eye. I had so much more to cover. I mean, to address specific charges and to be only given 30 minutes to respond, I thought was patently unfair.
It's an interesting situation. The accuser, in your case, it seems, Taylor, and correct me if I'm wrong, was the council itself. The stake president and his counselors acted as the accuser, and you, of course, as the accused. It seems an inherent conflict of interest in that the ones that are making the decision as to the validity of the claims made are the ones bringing the accusation themselves.
Yeah, I never got a straight answer out of the stake president about how he became aware of the book. It was 66 days to the day that he contacted me, or my bishop contacted me, to have a discussion about it. And that seems like a very short period of time because I had not gone around and talked to anybody in the ward, or I had a few friends on the stake level that I'd mentioned things to, but I was not publicly advocating or promoting the book at all. And I suspect that some algorithm in Salt Lake looking for books on Mormonism found this out. And, you know, then you go through the channels and the handbook says that anytime there's an apostasy charge, it has to get elevated to the regional 70. So I'm sure that they followed that to the letter. And when I asked the stake president about it, I am no FBI agent, but he looks at the ceiling, you know, and I can't remember how I came to where, oh, yeah, I think I saw somebody at church with it or something. I mean, it just smacked of deception.
Well, moving on, 19 through 22 just kind of talks about rehearings and if, you know, they find that they made a mistake or something like that. 23, though, is interesting. In case of difficulty respecting doctrine or principle, if there is not a sufficiency written to make the case clear to the minds of the council, the president may inquire and obtain the mind of the Lord by revelation. This one I just love because how many times will the church stand up and say, oh, we just don't know. We don't know what's going to happen with this. And we don't know that. We don't know what the Lord's will is on this. And here we have it. It says, well, just go ask the Lord. Obtain the mind of the Lord by revelation. And it doesn't happen.
Well, what's the definition of doctrine or principle, right? Is it the word of the Lord or is it the precepts of men? What's the standard by which you measure somebody? And it's clear that the standard by which I was measured was the handbook with the apostate definition of apostasy. Because no one was willing to actually reason with me via the scriptures. In fact, one of the members of the council said, well, would you be willing to pull your book and let us reason with you? And I said, that's what I had hoped would have happened before this whole trial got called. But neither my bishop nor the stake president were actually willing to read the book and demonstrate where I'm wrong. They just went to the second half of the book, which is analysis of where we are and some of the conclusions, and say, oh, you're in apostasy because you drew that conclusion. Well, did you actually read all the evidence I present as to how I came to that conclusion? No, they wouldn't reason at all via the scriptures, which is actually a point that one of my, he's not even a close friend, but he's an acquaintance who wrote a letter in defense. And he said, try to reason with Taylor via the scriptures. Can you even do that? I mean, he challenged them and he got called in front of his bishop because he wrote that in defense of me. It's really sad.
So then 24 kind of shifts and talks about the ability to set these councils up in other areas. So when the high priests are abroad, they can appoint one of their own number to preside over the council. Then, as I mentioned earlier, once they've made a decision, they have a duty to transmit immediately a copy of their proceedings with a full statement of the testimony accompanying their decision to the high council of the seat of the presidency of the church. Should the parties of either of them be dissatisfied with the decision of said council, they may appeal to the high council of the seat of the first presidency of the church and have a rehearing.
Keep going. Keep going. Which case shall be conducted according to the former pattern as though no such decision had been made. And so it's a completely new trial as if there was no original trial if the parties are dissatisfied.
Good point. And then lastly, this council of high priests abroad is only to be called on in the most difficult cases of the church matters. No common or ordinary case is to be sufficient to call such council. The traveling or located high priests abroad have power to say whether it is necessary to call such a council or not. And then this takes us to verse 30 to the end. And these were actually not in the transcript, but they were added when the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants was published. And one way we can tell is that it talks about the Council of 12 Apostles, which hadn't been created when this meeting took place, but had just been created shortly before the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants was created. So it informs us that there is a distinction between this High Council or the traveling high priests abroad and the traveling High Council composed of the 12 Apostles in their decisions. From the decision of the former, the traveling high priest, there can be appeal, but from the decision of the latter, the 12 apostles, there cannot. The latter can only be called in question by the general authorities of the church in case of transgression. So this seems to be setting really clear boundaries. Outside the organized stakes of Zion, the 12 apostles are the supreme body. But Joseph would later go on to clarify inside those stakes of Zion, they have no authority whatsoever. They are out in the world among the nations, but where there are organized branches, the high priests reign supreme.
Yeah, you make a great point there, Chris, that the 12 apostles only rule outside of the stakes of Zion. And their word is final in those cases without appeal. I think if someone were to ask Salt Lake, what is this high council of the seat of the first presidency of the church today? They would say, well, it's the first presidency and the 12 apostles. And yet section 102 makes a clear distinction between inside and outside. And we've talked about this before. The 12 apostles should be outside preaching the gospel to non-members, not being administrators inside the church.
And 32 goes so far as to say that the latter, talking about the apostles, can only be called in question, their decisions can only be called in question by the general authorities of the church in case of transgression. In today's definition, they are the general authorities of the church. So it's an interesting discrepancy as to how it's applied in today's tradition.
Yeah, and we also have section 124, which names the quorum of the 12 apostles with Brigham Young at its head, and then goes and names this quorum of high priests. They're two different groups of people. They're not the same organization. So where's the revelation from the Lord combining those two into one? I think that pretty much wraps this up. The last part is just the names of the 12 that were called to that committee, and they wrap it up. So this is an interesting one because it is not a revelation, but there are some rules that were established by Joseph that some of them are still obeyed today and others are completely ignored today.
Surprise, surprise.
So section 103 was received just a week later on February 24th of 1834. And we had Parley Pratt and Lyman White, who had just arrived in Kirtland from Missouri, and they're reporting to this high council in Kirtland about what's going on in Missouri. And they're asking, how are we going to redeem Zion from our enemies? And so then Joseph dictated this revelation, and then this became the impetus for creating Zion's camp and for marching down to Independence to try to redeem Zion. And before adjourning, the council appointed Joseph Smith as commander-in-chief of the armies of Israel and the leader of those who volunteered to go. Verse 1, verily I say unto you, my friends, and as we said in the previous episode, this is very specific language, usually addressed to high priests who have been sanctified. We don't know exactly who comprised this committee, but it would seem just by that, if the Lord's being consistent, then this is a group of high priests that have been sanctified. I will give unto you a revelation and commandment that you may know how to act in the discharge of your duties concerning the salvation and redemption of your brethren who have been scattered on the land of Zion. And that was the first thing that just jumped out at me. This group of 12, they have a duty now for the salvation and redemption of their brethren in the land of Zion. And I don't know exactly how or why, but he's not saying it's the responsibility of the people in Zion. He's actually saying it's your job. You guys here in Kirtland, you have duty concerning this. And in verse 2, these brethren who are scattered on the land of Zion, being driven and smitten by the hands of my enemies, on whom I will pour out my wrath without measure in mine own time. This is the first time where I've seen the Lord refer to the people in Missouri as his enemies. I may be wrong, but this is the first time I've noticed it.
Well, they were certainly persecuting the Lord's people, but it's interesting as we go on here where the Lord says, I have suffered them thus far that they might fill up the measure of their iniquities, that their cup might be full, and that those who call themselves after my name might be chastened for a little season with a sore and grievous chastisement, because they did not hearken altogether unto the precepts and commandments which I gave unto them. He's not really happy with the saints in Zion, and he's saying those who call themselves after my name. That's a key bit of information that says, I'm not claiming them. They're saying they're mine, but I'm not claiming them right now, but I will. He talks about how he will make up his jewels with them at some point. But I also key here off of the in mine own time, which to me points to a future fulfillment of the Lord redeeming Zion. For his ways are not our ways. His timetable is not ours.
And the other thing that I really key off on here is that he's suffering these enemies to go ahead and do this, that their cup may be full, and because I got to chasten these people that were not listening to the things I said. And that takes me to Mormon chapter 4, where it says, it's by the wicked that the wicked are punished, for it is the wicked that stir up the hearts of the children of men unto bloodshed. And so it would seem that the children of Zion are wicked because they're not obeying God. And then the other non-members are also wicked because they're now being stirred up unto bloodshed. And both are kind of accomplishing the Lord's purpose.
So the chastisement does bring to mind Hebrews 12 and other locations within Doctrine and Covenants where the Lord declares that whom he loves, he chastens. And so he's going to chasten his people because he loves them, but it's a grievous chastisement, unfortunately. I find it interesting what it goes on in verse 5 and 6 in particular, Verily, I say unto you that I have decreed a decree which my people shall realize, inasmuch as they hearken from this very hour unto the counsel which I, the Lord, their God, shall give unto them. Behold, they shall, for I have decreed it, begin to prevail against mine enemies from this very hour. It's clear that it's conditional. They had already failed in the past, which is why they were receiving the grievous chastisement. But he says that if you don't hearken from this very hour to do what I tell you to do, I cannot fulfill this decree. You will begin to prevail against your enemies from this very hour, but it's conditional on taking counsel from the Lord.
And the promise is even bigger than that, because in verse 7, he says that, and by hearkening to observe all the words which I shall speak unto them, they shall never cease to prevail until the kingdoms of the world are subdued under my feet and the earth is given unto the saints to possess it forever and ever. Well, that's the second coming in the millennium. And he's saying, you'll never cease to prevail until the millennium is ushered in. That hasn't happened. This also takes me back to the Book of Mormon in Mosiah chapter 2, verse 31. We read that if ye shall keep the commandments of God, which shall be delivered unto you, ye shall prosper in the land, and your enemies shall have no power over you. So it seems to be a very similar promise. Do the things I tell you, and I'll take care of you. Ignore me, and I'll ignore you.
Right, verse 8 says that, but inasmuch as they keep not my commandments and hearken not to observe all my words, the kingdoms of the world shall prevail against them.
And that's exactly what happened. It's hard to overstate how important these verses are in identifying the fact that we don't have the fullness, that we're under chastisement, because if we had the fullness and if we had been obedient, we would not have been moved out of our place. And the other data point here is that when the saints are in Nauvoo, he says that they will not be moved out of their place. We have these two warnings of the Lord. If you're obedient, you won't be moved out of your place. He said that in Nauvoo. And in Zion, he said, you would never cease to prevail. And yet, verse 8 is what's happened. The kingdoms of the world have prevailed against the Latter-day Saints. And that's just a fact. And the implications of that challenge what we hear in our lesson manuals, in Sunday school, from the pulpit, in General Conference, about having the fullness.
Painfully obvious that we did not prevail against our enemies in Kirtland. We did not prevail against our enemies in Far West. We did not prevail against our enemies in Nauvoo. These verses tell us that that's because we weren't obedient. And then other scriptures tell us that if we are obedient, God will give us further light and knowledge. But if we aren't obedient, he'll take away that which we even already have. And so in the face of all this disobedience, because we're being persecuted by our enemies, the church is also claiming, oh, we were obedient and receiving further light and knowledge. You can't have both.
If polygamy is a true principle and the saints were following the Lord and adhering to it, why would the Lord not intervene to prevent the United States government from forcing the saints, under threat of confiscating their temples and all of their property, to rescind this principle? Why didn't the Lord protect them if that were a true principle?
Yeah, I mean, we have this other verse that we love to quote. I, the Lord, am bound when you do what I say, but if you don't do it, you have no promise. The Lord didn't keep the promise, so the only logical conclusion is we didn't obey.
Exactly. So the Lord goes on in verse 11 and says, verily I say unto you, I have decreed that your brethren which have been scattered shall return to the lands of their inheritances and shall build up the waste places of Zion. So has that happened? No. This is a future prophecy. Looking through that future lens as we read, for after much tribulation, as I have said unto you in a former commandment, comes the blessing. Behold, this is the blessing which I have promised after your tribulations and the tribulations of your brethren, your redemption and the redemption of your brethren, even their restoration to the land of Zion, to be established, no more to be thrown down. Nevertheless, if they pollute their inheritance, they shall be thrown down, for I will not spare them if they pollute their inheritances. That's a future prophecy.
Yeah, it talks about after these tribulations, they'll be restored to the land of Zion. Well, we've had tribulations, but we're still not restored to the land of Zion. And then if they pollute their inheritances, they shall be thrown down. Well, in D&C 101, verse 6, the Lord warned us that the jarring contentions, envying strifes, and lustful and covetous desires were the things by which they polluted their inheritances. Have we gotten rid of all of those?
If we had, Zion could be redeemed even today.
Well, it's interesting that verse 11 is that they're to build up the waste places of Zion. It's interesting that it specifically captures the waste places. Could it be that the hedge was taken down and the enemies were able to overcome them and tear down the tower and everything because of the slothfulness of the people? The land of Zion was laid waste. Perhaps I'm reading too much into that, but yields destruction, or not the glorious Zion that the Lord talks about elsewhere in Scripture, but it's the waste places of Zion that they'll return to build it up, which speaks to something not as it should be, and they have to return to reclaim it.
I'm looking at Webster's 1828, destroyed, ruined, desolate, uncultivated, destitute. This is a land that has lost its status.
Exactly. And then in verse 15, we are told how Zion would be redeemed. For behold, I say unto you, the redemption of Zion must needs come by power. Therefore, I will raise up unto my people a man who shall lead them like as Moses led the children of Israel. For ye are the children of Israel and of the seed of Abraham, and ye must needs be led out of bondage by power, and with a stretched out arm. And as your fathers were led at the first, even so shall the redemption of Zion be. Therefore, let not your hearts faint. For I say not unto you as I did unto your fathers, mine angel shall go up before you, but not my presence. But I say unto you, mine angel shall go up before you, and also my presence, and in time ye shall possess the goodly land. There are factions out there in Mormondom that teach that Zion is just going to be this organic process that people are going to decide and make some covenant and become a Zion-like people. And yet, what does it say right here? Must needs be redeemed with power, led out of bondage by power. This metaphor of a stretched out arm is the arm of the Lord bringing power to sweep away the enemies, to clear the way. I think there are lots of ways to think about that. But this is how Zion is going to be redeemed. And yet we never talk about this in the Mormon church. Our model of the last days, if you were to ask any member, they'd probably say, well, Jesus is just going to show up at General Conference one of these years after we've preached enough of the word to the rest of the world, and it's all going to be done. Totally unscriptural. I heard somebody the other day say, well, I think it's going to happen in 2025. You know, he's just going to show up at General Conference. No, he's not. People are going to have to flee to Zion. They're going to have to make a choice, and Zion's going to be redeemed through the Lord's power, not through some organic process.
There are so many word links here. Verse 16, I will raise up a man. This is in 1834, and he's saying, in the future, I will raise up a man. So we can't say that this is Joseph in 1820 or even in 1830. He's talking, sometime in the future after 1834, I will raise up a man who will lead them like Moses led the children of Israel. Well, where did Moses lead the children of Israel? He led them from captivity to the promised land. He didn't start in Zion and then take them to Zion. He started out of Zion and took them to the promised land. And then the word link here that they need to be led out of bondage. So that means we need to be in a state of bondage. I don't think the LDS church would describe their current condition as a state of bondage, but by power and with a stretched out arm. And if you go look at that, you get tons of references in the Old Testament and it links back to Moses. I'll just read a couple from Deuteronomy 5:15. Remember that thou was a servant in the land of Egypt, and that the Lord thy God brought thee out thence through a mighty hand and by a stretched out arm. You get that in chapter 4:34. God has essayed to go and take him a nation from the midst of another nation by temptations, by signs, and by wonders, and by war, and by a mighty hand, and by a stretched out arm, and by great terrors, according to all that the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes. And you can just keep following that through. This is miraculous power, power over the elements, the cosmos in chaos. It is not just a quiet old man leading things. This is going to be earth-shaking events if you really believe what the Lord means when he says with power and a stretched out arm.
This link to raise up a man who shall lead them like Moses, that reminds me of the Joseph the seer prophecy of 2 Nephi chapter 3, where Lehi is seeing Joseph of our day. Verse 7, thus saith the Lord unto me, a choice seer will I raise up out of the fruit of thy loins, and he shall be esteemed highly among the fruit of thy loins. And unto him will I give commandment that he shall do a work for the fruit of thy loins, his brethren, which shall be of great worth unto them, even to the bringing of them to the knowledge of the covenants which I have made with thy fathers. And I will give unto him a commandment that he shall do none other work save the work which I shall command him. And I will make him great in mine eyes, for he shall do my work. And he shall be great like unto Moses, whom I have said I would raise up unto you to deliver my people, O house of Israel. So there's another link. What we haven't read yet is verse 21 of section 103, where the Lord says, verily I say unto you that my servant Joseph Smith Jr. is the man to whom I liken the servant to whom the Lord of the vineyard spake in the parable which I have given you. We talked about this in the last episode. Section 101 gives this parable of this servant who is going to redeem the Lord's vineyard. And the Lord is saying that redemption is going to happen through Joseph Smith. Has that happened yet? No, it hasn't. And so I draw the conclusion, because I believe the scriptures, that Joseph is going to return to redeem Zion, to lead us to Zion. And I know people find that fantastical. Apologists argue, no, it's not Joseph. Well, they don't believe what the Lord is saying very clearly right here. And I present other evidences of this in my book. We won't get sidetracked on that right now. But I believe Joseph's going to return and fulfill this role. He will be raised up, whatever that means, resurrected. I'm not going to speculate.
I prefer raised from the dead. I always like to use the example of Lazarus. It's like, will you believe that Jesus was able to raise Lazarus from the dead after 4 days? Yeah, but Joseph's been dead for 200 years. Oh, so that's impossible for God? He wouldn't do that. Well, he says it's a strange act. Why don't you believe him? It's funny how they can totally believe that Jesus had power to raise people from the dead, and he has power to resurrect all of us, but he doesn't have the power to raise one man from the dead after 200 years. That's just beyond the pale.
That's called dwindling in unbelief.
Well, or just false traditions of your fathers.
I come back to verse 15 to where he says that Zion must needs come by power. And when you look into the history and, of course, into the revelations, you see a desire by the church, particularly some of these high councils of the church, to receive their endowment of power from the Lord in the Lord's house. And I think there's a direct tie here that people want to say that it must needs come by power. And how many thought, well, it's because we need to get our mighty men and we need to go deliver it according to our own power. But it is according to the power of the Lord. And so that it just puts you in a mindset of thinking about it being by the Lord's power and the Lord's deliverance rather than our own. I know it's future sections where it talks about that Zion cannot be built up except upon the principles of the celestial kingdom. Otherwise, he cannot receive it unto himself. It's by the power of the Lord that this is to happen. We know the Zion's camp ultimately failed in its redemption of Zion, which speaks to the fact that it didn't come by power, because the Lord's promise is that it would be redeemed by power, and they didn't have that power yet. And perhaps speaks to another reason why they were so earnest in their desire to receive that endowment of power.
Yeah, and as you're just saying that, Quinn, it reminds me of a couple other places in the Doctrine and Covenants and even in Isaiah where the Lord makes it clear that he will fight their battles. 105:14, for behold, I do not require at their hands to fight the battles of Zion. For as I said in a former commandment, even so will I fulfill. I will fight your battles. Section 98:37 says the same thing. I, the Lord, would fight their battles and their children's children's until they have avenged themselves of all their enemies. And so the Lord is promising that he will fight the battles of Zion. This is not going to be by force of arms of, you know, gathering together thousands and thousands. The Lord is going to fight their battles, just like he preserved the children of Israel coming out of Egypt. He fought their battles.
And that leads us into the last couple of verses you read there, where it talks about my angel shall go up before you, but not my presence in the old days. And in the future day, it'll be my angel shall go up before you and also my presence. And so you can go look in the Old Testament, Exodus 23, the Lord promises to send an angel before Moses and the house of Israel to guard you on the way and to bring you to the place that I prepared. In other places, like in Isaiah 63:9, it talks about this angel being the angel of his presence and how it saved them. At Sinai, the intention was they were going to get the full presence of God. And then because of the disobedience, the Lord's like, I can't give you my full presence, but I'll send this angel and my presence will be there in a different way. But the Lord's saying it'll be like with Moses, but even better, because this time you will have my presence. You'll have angels and you'll have my presence. When has that happened?
Certainly not in Missouri in 1838.
As far as I can tell, it hasn't happened by November of 2021 yet.
Still waiting.
A couple of other things. Talks about the redemption of Zion. So Zion needs to be redeemed. This takes us right back to section 113 again, where it's talking about Isaiah chapter 52, verse 1. Put on thy strength, O Zion. What does that mean? He had reference to those whom God should call in the last days, who should hold the power of priesthood to bring again Zion and the redemption of Israel. And talks about the authority of the priesthood to return to that power which she had lost. We keep coming back to this. It's right there in the scriptures. The power was lost, and it will have to be restored before Israel can be redeemed. And a couple of other things that just jumped out at me were some links to Jeremiah. And in Jeremiah 16, we get the people saying, why has the Lord pronounced all this great evil against us? What is our iniquity? What is the sin that we have committed against the Lord our God? And then the Lord says, you shall say unto them, because your fathers have forsaken me and gone after other gods and have served and worshiped them and have forsaken me and have not kept my law. And because you have done worse than your fathers, for behold, every one of you follows his stubborn, evil will, refusing to listen to me. Therefore, I will hurl you out of this land. And he goes on, but then he talks about when he'll bring them back. So in verse 14, he says, therefore, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when it shall no longer be said, as the Lord lives, who brought up the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt, but as the Lord lives, who brought the people of Israel out of the north country and out of all the countries where he had driven them, for I will bring them back to their own land that I gave to their fathers. In verse 18, he says, but first, I will doubly repay their iniquity and their sin, because they have polluted my land with the carcasses of their detestable idols and have filled my inheritance with their abominations. So you just see this pattern repeating itself where the people of the Lord pollute their inheritance. They have to be driven out. But the Lord always says, after you've served your time, I'll bring you back again. It isn't forever.
I always have to try to throttle my emotions with respect to the church and realize, you know, the Lord is working with each of us. And sometimes it's easy for me to cast stones. At some point, we're all going to come to a unity of the faith, but it's an individual responsibility for us to choose if we're going to listen to the word of the Lord or we're going to listen to the precepts of men. And I believe there are so many good people who, you know, when they truly see how blind we are, will repent. But the scriptures also verify that there's going to be a vast majority, probably, who don't. You know, a light breaks forth to those who sit in darkness. It is the fullness of my gospel, but they perceive it not because of the precepts of men. Those words are like sorrowful words, recognizing the fact that those who are just dutifully following the prophet, if they don't repent, are not going to participate in the beauties of Zion.
It takes me back to Isaiah 54. I love that chapter. And of course, echoed in the Book of Mormon and 3 Nephi, where the Lord says, "For a small moment have I forsaken thee, but with great mercies will I gather thee. In a little wrath I hid my face from thee for a moment, but with everlasting kindness will I have mercy on thee, saith the Lord thy Redeemer." He goes on to say, "O thou afflicted, tossed with tempest and not comforted, behold, I will lay thy stones with fair colors and lay thy foundations with sapphires and will make thy windows of agates and thy gates carbuncles," all these pleasant stones, he says, "and all thy children shall be taught of the Lord, and great shall be the peace of thy children, and in righteousness shalt thou be established. Thou shalt be far from oppression, for thou shalt not fear, and from terror, for it shall not come near thee." Just the mercy and the grace of God in acknowledging that for a small moment, his people have been forsaken, but in everlasting kindness, he will gather them. Just as Christ echoed in the New Testament numerous times, even as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, even so I have tried to gather you and yet you would not. But we have his promise ultimately that in everlasting kindness, he'll gather his people. But it is in righteousness that they will be established, and it's according to his righteousness.
Yes, and that takes me to, Taylor, I can't believe you didn't pull up this verse and reference it.
Jeremiah 23, I'm guessing.
Absolutely. So it starts off, "Woe to the shepherds who destroy and scatter the sheep of my pasture." He goes on and talks about all the bad things, "and I will attend to you for your evil deeds, and I'll gather the remnant of my flock out of all the countries." And in verse 7, "Therefore, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when they shall no longer say, 'As the Lord lives, who brought up the people out of the land of Egypt,' but 'As the Lord lives, who brought up and led the offspring of the house of Israel out of the north country and out of all the countries where he had driven them, then they shall dwell in their own land.'" And then he proceeds to go right back in concerning the prophets, "My heart is broken within me," and the whole rest of Jeremiah 23. The Lord has given us a direct link. This last time when he gathers us, just like he did with Moses, we're going to be surrounded by these shepherds that destroy the flock, by these false prophets that are telling the people things they shouldn't be telling them. Lots of links.
Yeah, and we're supposed to ask those prophets, "What has the Lord answered thee and what has he spoken? Tell us the words of the Lord." And we're still waiting patiently. All right, well, that was an interesting tangent. Should we keep going? We ended where the Lord identified Joseph as that servant who is going to be like Moses. Verse 22, "Therefore, let my servant Joseph Smith say unto the strength of my house, my young men and the middle-aged, gather yourselves together unto the land of Zion, unto the land which I have bought with money, has been consecrated unto me. And let all the churches send up wise men and their monies and purchase lands, even as I have commanded. And inasmuch as mine enemies come out against you to drive you from my goodly land, which I have consecrated to be the land of Zion, even from your own lands, after these testimonies which ye have brought before me against them, ye shall curse them. And whomsoever ye curse, I will curse, and ye shall avenge me of mine enemies. and my presence shall be with you, even in avenging me of mine enemies, unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. Let no man be afraid to lay down his life for my sake, for whoso layeth down his life for my sake shall find it again. And whoso is not willing to lay down his life for my sake is not my disciple. Send up your monies, buy more land. If they gather against you, curse them, and I will curse them. The Lord will curse them, and ye shall avenge me of mine enemies. So I imagine these sorts of words were in some of the minds of the saints when in 1838, several years later, they went out against his enemies. But it was clear at that point that his presence was not with them in fighting their battles.
Yeah, 26 for me is the big one. Hey, guys, his presence wasn't there. It was nothing like the biblical story, and you lost. That should be a big clue to us that something went wrong. We got off track somewhere.
Yeah, and we ceased trying to actually establish Zion. You know, Joseph was asked at that period of time if the saints were still going to live the law of consecration, and he disclaimed it. He said no. And certainly in Nauvoo, that was not the case. I mean, it was capitalism unleashed with development and everybody building their own houses. It was not a collective effort in Nauvoo whatsoever. Lord goes on, verse 29, tells his servant Sidney Rigdon to lift up his voice in the congregations of the eastern countries, preparing the churches to keep the commandments which I have given them concerning the restoration and redemption of Zion. So this was sending people out to collect. They now had to get these at least 100. And so they're trying to gather people to go on this Zion camp expedition. It is my will that Parley P. Pratt and Lyman White, okay, who just came from Zion to Kirtland, should not return to the land of their brethren. So don't go back to Zion right away, until they have obtained companies to go up unto the land of Zion by tens or by 20s or by 50s or by 100, until they have obtained to the number of 500 of the strength of my house. Behold, this is my will. Ask and ye shall receive. But men do not always do my will. Therefore, if you cannot obtain 500, seek diligently that peradventure, which means perhaps, you may obtain 300. And if you cannot obtain 300, seek diligently that perhaps ye may obtain 100. But verily I say unto you, a commandment I give unto you, that you shall not go up unto the land of Zion until you have obtained 100 of the strength of my house to go up with you unto the land of Zion. So that's the minimum number.
It is interesting looking into the history of the numbers associated with Zion's camp. This revelation occurred in February, end of February. It was on the 1st of May was the initial day appointed to begin the march from Kirtland to Zion. On that day, there were only about 20 people ready to go on that day. And so Joseph sent them down to another city, New Portage, not far from there, where they would wait for the rest. By the 4th of May, there were about 80 volunteers had assembled in Kirtland. And so then they come together and begin the march. So with Joseph, it's where the 80 men that came after met with the 20, and that yielded the minimum number that the Lord had identified of 100 to begin the trek. And then they had some join as they went along. And then Hiram and Lyman taking off from Michigan had about 20 people with them. And so there were just over 200 men with women and children. In addition to that, was the highest number once they came together. But it's interesting, just in the minimum that the Lord had identified was the minimum that they could muster. And then the trials and everything that came along with that. That's a fascinating story. I don't know all of it by any stretch of the means, but.
Yeah, I suspect we'll get into it a little bit in future episodes as we get to that time frame.
Therefore, as I said unto you, ask and ye shall receive. Pray earnestly that peradventure my servant Joseph Smith Jr. may go with you and preside in the midst of my people and organize my kingdom upon the consecrated land and establish the children of Zion upon the laws and commandments which have been and which shall be given unto you. It almost seems to me, and I don't know if you guys read this the same way, that it's not a foregone conclusion that Joseph's going with them.
That's the way I read that and saw that. But I wondered also if 35 is speaking a little more outside of the Zion's camp, as we identify it. But the people in Zion, in Jackson County, were very anxious to have Joseph come and live in Zion and preside with them. But it was never acknowledged by the Lord that that should happen. In fact, it was something that the Lord here, even specifically, that's why I think of it, he counsels them to pray and seek for that, that perhaps he will come to Zion and preside in your midst and redeem these lands. It made me question whether it's speaking specifically about the Zion's camp experience or more generally about once Zion is established or redeemed, that perhaps Joseph will be able to remain there and preside in Zion as they had wanted for a long time.
The thing that I really focus on here is this establishing the children of Zion upon the laws and commandments. Wait a minute. They established Zion almost 3 years earlier. They dedicated the land. They were calling people. The Lord seems to be saying the children of Zion thus far haven't truly established themselves upon the laws and commandments which I have given them. And getting back to what you were talking about, Joseph Smith turned down those invitations to relocate to Zion because he said, I can't move there until you guys start obeying the commandments you've already received. So I read this not as Joseph coming there in the summer of 1834 with the Zion's camp as the fulfillment of it, but saying, hey, if you guys really knuckle down and start repenting and doing what you're supposed to do, then peradventure, Joseph can come and establish you. But until you guys change your act, there's not a whole lot we can do.
Well, and by definition, it means that they did not follow the Lord's law.
Right. We've got a bunch of scriptures here. Doctrine and Covenants 42, verses 59 and 60. Thou shalt take the things which thou hast received, which have been given unto thee in my scriptures for a law, to be my law to govern the church. And he that does according to these things shall be saved, and he that does them not shall be damned, if he so continues. But pretty clear there. D&C 43, I give unto you a commandment that when you are assembled together, ye shall instruct and edify each other, that ye may know how to act and direct my church, how to act upon the points of my law and the commandments which I have been given. And thus ye shall become instructed in the law of my church, and be sanctified by that which ye have received, and ye shall bind yourselves to act in all holiness before me. And Doctrine and Covenants 58:23, behold, the laws which ye have received from my hand are the laws of the church, and in this light ye shall hold them forth. And yet he's saying, you guys haven't been doing that, but if you do establish yourselves upon them, then I'll come to your rescue. He didn't come to their rescue.
No, but the key to victory is told us in verse 36, all victory and glory is brought to pass unto you through your diligence, faithfulness, and prayers of faith. I think that's a general principle that we can apply both to the redemption of Zion, but even in our own lives, in whatever the Lord asks us to do. I remember as a missionary, this was one of my favorite verses in the Doctrine and Covenants, just to focus on, okay, we need to exercise our faith. We do that through prayer and being diligent and faithful. And the Lord will come to our rescue when we do that.
I love that principle. It's so succinct, verse 36, that all victory and glory is brought to pass because of that. It echoes to so many scriptures. We can't even talk about them all because of where the Lord is counseling diligence and faith, giving your whole soul as an offering to God. Even in Mosiah, where King Benjamin says that even if you do all of these things, yet you're unprofitable servants, because ultimately we rely 100% on our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And we rely on the grace of God for all that we have. And we may fool ourselves at times into thinking that we are worthy or can expect certain things because of what we have done. But it's only according to the grace of God. And I love the succinct nature of 36. and the message that it brings.
Well, I think that's a great place to wrap this episode up. So Quinn, I want to thank you for joining. And as we were talking throughout, you weren't participating as much, but you've got a great excuse because you and your wife just had a baby in the last month. So congratulations.
Thank you. Yep, we did indeed. She's beautiful. Baby girl.
That's awesome.
You go enjoy that time with your family. So Taylor, what are we going to cover next week?
We're going to hit 104, which is 85 verses, so I don't think we're going to get past 104. And then we're also going to talk about what happened on May 3rd, 1834, which is a very important date in church history that we never hear about over the pulpit.
Great. Well, I will look forward to that. I know what happened on that date, and I think it is incredibly significant. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Please share this with your friends. We'd love to get more listeners. Have a great Thanksgiving. You'll be listening to this afterwards. So hope you already had a great Thanksgiving, and we'll catch you next time. Bye.